Switch the subject of life.
Then I'll ask you straight out. Love is a task accomplished by two people. This is an example of pretending to state something while not actually stating anything at all. What on earth do these two people accomplish anyway?
Happiness. They accomplish a happy life.
Wow. You answered that right away.
We all wish to be happy. We live in the pursuit of a happier life. You will agree with that, yes?
Of course.
And in order to be happy, we have to take steps within our interpersonal relationships. All human problems are interpersonal relationship problems. And all human happiness is interpersonal relationship happiness. I have spoken about this several times before.
Yes, this is exactly why we have to embark on the life tasks.
Now, concretely speaking, what is happiness to a human being? That time 3 years ago, I mentioned Adler's conclusion with regard to happiness. In short, happiness is the feeling of contribution.
Right. It's a pretty bold conclusion to make.
As Adler puts it, for all of us, it is only when we can feel I am of use to someone that we can have a true awareness that we have worth. We can have a true awareness of our worth and gain the sense of belonging, that it's okay to be here. But on the other hand, we have no way of knowing whether our conduct is really useful. Because even if there is a person right in front of you who appears to be enjoying things, in principle, there is no way you can tell if they are really enjoying things. This brings us to the term feeling of contribution. All we need is the subjective sense that I am of use to someone, or in other words, a feeling of contribution. There is no need to look for any other basis. Try to find happiness in the feeling of contribution. Try to find joy in the feeling of contribution. We gain a true awareness that we are of use to someone through our work relationships. We gain a true awareness that we are of use to someone through our friend relationships. And if we do that, then happiness is right in front of us.
Yes, I accept that. Frankly speaking, what you are presenting now is the most simply put and most convincing of the various theories of happiness I have encountered. And conversely, that is exactly why I can't really get this argument that one can accomplish a happy life through love.
That could be the reason. Then please, stop for a moment and recall our discussion regarding division of labor. Lying at the very root of the division of labor was my happiness, that is to say, self-interest. Ultimately, my happiness, in effect, connects to someone else's happiness. A division of labor relationship is established. In a word, there is a healthy give and take at work. That is what we are talking about.
Yes, it's a very interesting discussion.
On the other hand, the thing that establishes a friend relationship is your happiness. One has unconditional confidence in the other party without seeking collateral or anything in return. There is no idea of give and take here. It is through an other-interested attitude of wholeheartedly believing and giving that friend relationships come about.
Give and it shall be given unto you, right?
Yes. In other words, it is by pursuing my happiness that we build division of labor relationships, and by pursuing your happiness that we build friend relationships. So what is it that we pursue that allows love relationships to come about?
I guess it'd be the happiness of the person one loves, a lofty, your happiness.
No, it is not.
Oh, so you're saying that love is really egoism? That is to say, my happiness?
It is not that either.
Then what is it?
Rather than the self-interested seeking of my happiness or the other interested wishing for your happiness, love is the building of a happiness of an inseparable us.
An inseparable us?
That's right. One upholds us as being higher than me or you. One maintains that order in all of one's choices in life. One does not give precedence to the happiness of me, and one is not satisfied with only the happiness of you. Unless it is the happiness of two of us, it has no meaning. Such is the task accomplished by two people.
So it's about being self-interested while also being other-interested?
No, it is not self-interested, and it is not other-interested either. Love has neither self-interest nor other interest. It rejects both.
Why?
Because that changes the subject of life.
The subject of life?
From the time we are born, we go about our lives looking at the world with the eyes of me, hearing sounds through the ears of me, and pursuing the happiness of me. This is so for all people. When one knows real love, however, the subject of life changes from me to us. It allows one to live by completely new guidelines that are of neither self-interest nor other interest.
But wouldn't that mean that the me would vanish into nothingness?
Indeed, the me should vanish into nothingness if one is to find a happy life.
What did you say?
Self-reliance is breaking away from me.
Love is a task accomplished by two people. Through love, two people accomplish a happy life. Then why does love connect to happiness? In short, it is because love is liberation from me.
Liberation from me?
Yes. When we are given life in this world, at first we reign supreme at the center of the world. Everyone in our vicinity worries about me, soothes us day and night, provides food, and even takes care of our excretions. Whenever me smiles, the world smiles too, and when me cries, the world hurries to our aid. In most cases, we are in a condition like a dictator who reigns over the household domain.
Well, that's how it is today, at least.
What is the source of this overwhelming, almost dictatorial power? Adler asserts that it is weakness, that in childhood we control the adults by way of our own weakness.
Because we are weak beings, the people in our vicinity have to help us?
Right. Weakness becomes a frightfully powerful weapon in an interpersonal relationship. This was a crucial discovery that Adler arrived at on the basis of deep insights gained from clinical practice. Let's use the story of a certain boy as an example. The boy was afraid of the dark. At night, his mother would put him to bed, turn out the light, and leave the room, and every time he would begin to cry. Since he would not stop crying, his mother would come back and ask him, "Why are you crying?" Once he had settled down, he would answer in a frail voice, "'Cause it's so dark." The mother, having perceived her son's goal, would ask him with a sigh, "So, now that I'm back, is it a little lighter?"
I'm sure it would be.
Darkness itself wasn't the problem. The thing that the boy feared and wanted to avoid most of all was being separated from his mother. As Adler puts it, by crying, calling her, not being able to sleep, or by some other means, he turns himself into a troublemaker and endeavors to keep his mother near him.
He controls his mother by calling special attention to his weakness.
That's right. To paraphrase Adler again, once they lived in a golden age in which everything they wanted was given to them. And among them, there are those who will still feel that if they cry enough, protest enough, and refuse to cooperate, they will continue to be able to get whatever they want. They are incapable of focusing on anything aside from their own individual profit, and they cannot see life and society as a whole.
A golden age. That's certainly the case. It is a golden age for the children, all right.
Children are not the only ones who choose such a way of living. There are many adults who treat their own weakness or misfortune, their hurt, troubled background, and trauma as a weapon and plot how they will control other people. They will try to control others by making them worry and by restricting their own words and actions. Adler referred to such adults as pampered children and was very critical of their lifestyle and worldview.
Ah, I can't stand it either. They always think they can fix things by crying, and that laying bare their hurt lets them off the hook. And they regard strong people as evil, and try to make their weak selves out to be good. According to their logic, it's not acceptable for us to get strong either, because if you get stronger, it means you've sold your soul to the devil and fallen into evil.
There is one thing we need to keep in mind here, however, and that is the physical inferiority of the child, in particular of the newborn baby who has just come into this world.
The newborn?
In principle, children are incapable of self-support. They control the adults around them by crying, that is to say, by calling attention to their own weakness, and if they cannot get the adults to do as they wish them to, they might not last another day. They are not crying because they are pampered or selfish. If they are going to live, they have no choice but to reign supreme at the center of the world.
Undoubtedly.
All human beings start off with an almost excessive self-centeredness. They would not survive otherwise. However, one cannot reign supreme at the center of the world forever. One has to make peace with the world and come to the understanding that one is a part of the world. If you are able to comprehend that, then the meaning of the term self-reliance, which we have discussed numerous times today, should become clear too.
The meaning of self-reliance?
That's right. Why the objective of education is self-reliance? Why Adlerian psychology treats education as one of the most important issues? What meaning is contained in the term self-reliance?
Please, tell me.
Self-reliance is breaking away from self-centeredness. This is why Adler called community feeling social interest, and also referred to it as concern for society and concern for others. We have to get past our obstinate self-centeredness and stop trying to be the center of the world. One has to break away from me. One has to break away from one's pampered childhood lifestyle.
So, when we can break away from self-centeredness, we can achieve self-reliance at last?
That's right. People can change. We can change that lifestyle, that worldview or outlook on life. And love can change the subject of life from me to us. It is through love that we are liberated from me that we achieve self-reliance and truly accept the world.
Accept the world?
Yes. To know love and to change the subject of life to us, this is a new start to life. The us that began as just two people will eventually broaden in scope to the entire community and the entire human race.
That is...
It is community feeling.
Love, self-reliance, and community feeling. Lo and behold, all of Adler's ideas are connected.
That's right. We are now nearing a major conclusion. Let's go down together to the very depths of the matter.
The love that the philosopher had begun talking about was something utterly different from what the youth had been expecting. Love is a task accomplished by two people, and what we must pursue therein is not the happiness of me or the happiness of you, but the happiness of us. Only then can we break away from me to be liberated from self-centeredness and achieve true self-reliance. To be self-reliant is to break away from one's childhood lifestyle and to get past one's self-centeredness. In that very moment, the youth had the intuition that he was trying to open a large door. What could be waiting for him on the other side of that door? Radiant light or inky darkness? All he knew for sure was that he had his hand on the doorknob of his own destiny. To whom is that love directed?
How deep are those depths?
When thinking about the relationship between love and self-reliance, the task one cannot avoid addressing is that of the parent-child relationship.
Ah, I get it. Of course. Of course.
Newborns are incapable of living by their own power. It is due to the constant devotion of other people, principally their mothers, that they are eventually able to sustain themselves. We are alive here and now because we had the love of our mothers and fathers, and because there was devotion. The person who thinks, I was raised without love from anyone, must not turn away from this fact.
That's true. There was an unsurpassably beautiful, selfless love.
But if we change the viewpoint, the love here involves a very troublesome matter that cannot be completely settled with the beautiful bond between parent and child.
What could it be?
No matter how much we reign supreme at the center of the world during childhood, we are dependent on our parents to stay alive. Our parents have power over the life of this me, and if we are abandoned by our parents, we will die. Children are intelligent enough to understand this, and at some point they realize it is because I'm loved by my parents that I can go on living.
Undoubtedly.
And it is exactly at that point in time that children choose their own lifestyles. What kind of place is this world in which they live? What kind of people inhabit it? And what about the children themselves? What kind of people are they? They choose their attitudes toward life of their own accord. Do you understand what this fact means?
No, I don't.
When we choose our lifestyle, its objective can only be to find out how I can be loved. We all choose a lifestyle for being loved as a survival strategy that is directly linked to our lives.
A lifestyle for being loved?
Children are excellent observers. They think about the environment in which they have been placed and take measure of the personalities and dispositions of their parents. If they have siblings, they surmise the positional relationships between them, take stock of their personalities, and consider which me will be loved. And on the basis of all these aspects, they choose their lifestyle. For example, at this point, there are children who choose the lifestyle of the good child who obeys their parents. And conversely, there are those who choose the lifestyle of the bad child who opposes, rejects, and rebels against almost everything.
But why? If they turn into the bad child, they won't stand a chance of being loved, will they?
This is a point that is frequently misunderstood. Children who cry, get angry, and shout in rebellion are not incapable of controlling their emotions. Actually, they control their emotions rather too well and turn them into action. Because they have the intuition that unless they go that far, they will never gain their parents' love and attention, and their very lives will be endangered.
So that's a survival strategy too.
That's right. A lifestyle for being loved is, in all respects, a self-centered lifestyle of garnering attention from others, however possible, and searching out how one can stand, however possible, at the center of the world.
It's all coming together, finally. Briefly put, the various problem behaviors my students engage in are based on that self-centeredness. So what you are saying is that their problem behavior comes out of their chosen lifestyle for being loved?
But that's not all. That how I can be loved, which is rooted in the survival strategies of your childhood, has probably become a criterion of the lifestyle you are adopting now.
What did you say?
In the truest sense of the word, you still have not achieved self-reliance. You are still stuck in a lifestyle of being someone's child. If you want to assist in your students' self-reliance and hope to become a true educator, first, you must be self-reliant yourself.
How can you make such assumptions? And on what grounds? I have entered the teaching profession and I live in that social circle. I have chosen my work of my own accord. I support myself on my own earnings, and I have never asked my parents for money or anything like that. I already am self-reliant.
But you do not love anyone yet.
Ugh!
Self-reliance is not an economic issue or a work issue. It is an attitude toward life, an issue of lifestyle. At some point, the time will come when you resolve to love someone. That will be when you achieve separation from your childhood lifestyle and achieve true self-reliance. Because it is through loving others that we at last become adults.
We become adults by loving?
Yes. Love is self-reliance. It is to become an adult. That is why love is difficult.
How can one get one's parents' love?
But I am self-reliant. I am not reliant on my parents anymore. Wanting to be loved by them never even crosses my mind. Instead of entering the profession my parents had hoped for, I worked for low pay at the university library, and now I am moving forward on the path of the educator. I've resolved to myself that even if this creates rifts in our parent-child relationship, I don't care, and I'm ready to be disliked. To me, at the very least, my choice of profession was a way of breaking away from my childhood lifestyle.
You have one sibling, an older brother, am I right?
Yes. My brother is taking over the printing plant that our father runs.
It seems that following the same path as your family did not sit right with you. The important thing to you was something different from everyone else. If you went into the same line of work as your father and your brother, you would not be able to garner attention, and you would not be able to realize your own worth.
What? What did you say?
But it goes beyond work. From early childhood onward, since your brother was older than you, no matter what you did, he had more power and more experience, and you never had the slightest chance of winning. Now, what could you do about it? According to Adler, in general, the youngest child chooses a path that differs completely from the other members of his family. In other words, if it is a family of scientists, he will become a musician or a merchant. If it is a family of merchants, he might become a poet. He must always be different from other people.
That's just an assumption. That is an assumption that makes a mockery of a person's free will.
Yes. Adler himself only spoke of tendencies with regard to sibling birth order. However, it is useful to know what sort of tendencies are brought about by the environment one is placed in.
Then what about my brother? What sort of tendencies does he have?
For the first-born child, and also for the only child, the greatest privilege may be that one had a time in which one monopolized one's parents' love. Later-born children do not have the experience of monopolizing their parents. They always have a rival who is ahead of them, and in many cases they are placed in competition relationships. Yet the first-born child who has monopolized their parents' love on the birth of a brother or sister will be forced to come down from that position. The first-born child who does not cope with this setback satisfactorily will hope to someday regain that seat of power. Adler refers to this as being a worshipper of the past who creates a lifestyle that is conservative and is pessimistic with regard to the future.
My brother certainly does have such tendencies.
It is a lifestyle in which one has a perception of the importance of strength and authority, enjoys wielding one's power, and places excessive value on the rule of law. It is a true conservative lifestyle. Yet, when a brother or sister is born, the first-born child, who has already received education with regard to cooperation and assistance, is likely to develop into an excellent leader. In imitation of the child-rearing done by the parents, such a first-born finds joy in taking care of siblings and learns the meaning of contribution.
Then what about the second child? In my case, I am the second child, but also the last-born. What sorts of tendencies does the second child have?
Adler says that a typical second child is instantly recognizable. The second child always has a pace setter running ahead of them. And at the heart of the second child, there lies the feeling of, I want to catch up. They want to catch up with their elder brother or sister. To catch up, they have to hurry. They are constantly pushing themselves and planning how to catch up with, overtake, and even triumph over their elder brother or sister. Unlike the conservative first-born child who holds the rule of law in high regard, the second child wishes to overturn even the natural law of birth order. So second children aim for revolution. Rather than trying to be at peace with the existing powers that be, as first-born children do, they place worth on overthrowing the powers that be.
You're saying that I've got the tendencies of a rash revolutionary?
Well, I don't know about that, because this classification is purely an aid to human understanding. It does not actually determine anything.
Lastly, then, what about the only child? Since there are no rivals above or below, the only child gets to always stay in the seat of power?
It is true that the only child has no siblings who would become rivals. But in this situation, it is the parents who become the rivals. The child wants so much to have his mother's love all to himself that he ends up seeing his father as a rival. He is in an environment that is conducive to the development of the so-called mother complex.
Oh, that's a rather Freudian idea, isn't it?
But the issue that Adler regarded as more problematic here is the situation of psychological anxiety in which the solitary child is placed.
Psychological anxiety?
First of all, the child is exposed to the anxiety of always having to look around him, in the worry that a younger brother or sister will be born and that his position will be threatened. More than anything, he lives in fear of the birth of a new prince or a new princess. And beyond that, he needs to watch out for the cowardice of his parents.
The cowardice of his parents?
That's right. There are couples who, on having one child, tell themselves that economically speaking, and in terms of the amount of work it would require, there's no way we can afford to raise any more children and refrain from having any more, regardless of their actual economic situation. According to Adler, many such couples are cowardly in their lives and pessimistic. Moreover, anxiety pervades the atmosphere in their homes, and they place an excessive amount of pressure on their only children and make them suffer. As having more than one child was the norm in Adler's time, he laid more emphasis on this point.
So parents can't just be devoted to loving their children, right?
Yes. Limitless love so often transforms into a tool for controlling the child. All parents must uphold the clear objective of self-reliance and go about building equal relationships with their children.
And then, regardless of what sort of people their parents are, the children can't help but choose a lifestyle for being loved.
That's right. The fact that in spite of your parents' opposition you chose to work as a librarian and are now choosing the path of the educator is not enough on its own to say that you have become self-reliant. Perhaps by choosing a different path, you are actually trying to win the sibling rivalry and keep hold of your parents' attention. And perhaps by attaining something on that different path, you are hoping to be recognized for your worth as a human being. Perhaps you are attempting to overthrow the existing powers that be and to accede to the throne.
If that's true, what then?
You are all caught up in the need for approval. You live thinking about how you can be loved by other people, how you can be recognized by other people. Even the path of the educator, which it would seem you chose yourself, may be a life of the me that others wish for. A life that has the objective of being recognized by others.
This path, this life I've chosen as an educator?
As long as you hold on to a childhood lifestyle, you will not be able to wipe away that possibility.
Hey, what do you know anyway? I'm just sitting here listening quietly while you go ahead and fabricate stuff about people's family relationships and even try to negate me as an educator.
To be sure, one cannot realize self-reliance by gaining employment. Generally speaking, we live controlled by our parents' love. We choose our lifestyle at a time when we can only crave to be loved by our parents. And further, we grow older and become adults while reinforcing that lifestyle of being loved. To get out from under the control of the love one is given, the only thing one can do is love oneself by loving. Not waiting to be loved or waiting for destiny, but loving someone of one's own accord. That is the only way.
People are afraid of loving.
So even though you usually reduce everything to courage, this time you're trying to settle it all as being about love?
Love and courage are closely connected. You do not yet know love. You are afraid of love, and you are hesitant about love. Consequently, you are stuck in your childhood lifestyle. You do not have enough courage to dive into love.
I am afraid of love?
As Fromm says, while one is consciously afraid of not being loved, the real, though usually unconscious, fear is that of loving. And then he continues by stating, to love means to commit oneself without guarantee, to give oneself completely. Love is an act of faith, and whoever is of little faith is also of little love. For example, the moment one has the slightest feeling that the other is showing goodwill toward one, one becomes interested in the other person and then starts to like them. This kind of thing often happens, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It would be no exaggeration to say that most love affairs happen that way.
This is a condition in which one has secured some guarantee of being loved, even if it is all one's own misunderstanding. One feels some kind of collateral there. That person probably likes me, or they probably won't reject my goodwill. And it is on the basis of that collateral that we can begin to love more deeply. On the other hand, the loving that Fromm speaks of does not provide any such collateral. One loves regardless of what the other person thinks of one. One throws oneself into love.
One must not seek collateral in love.
Right. Why do people seek collateral in love? Do you know?
They don't want to get hurt or feel miserable. I guess that's why.
No. Rather, it is that they think, I'll definitely get hurt. Or they half convince themselves, I'm definitely going to feel miserable.
What?
You do not love yourself yet. You are not able to respect yourself or have confidence in yourself. That is why you end up assuming that in a love relationship you will definitely get hurt or definitely feel miserable, because you think that there couldn't be anyone who could love someone like you.
But that's just the truth, isn't it?
I am a person without any outstanding traits. That is why I cannot build a love relationship with anyone. I cannot embark on love without collateral. This is a typical inferiority complex way of thinking, because one is using one's feelings of inferiority as an excuse for not resolving one's tasks.
But...
One separates the tasks. Loving is your task. But how will the other person respond to your love? That is the other person's task and is not something you can control. What you can do is separate the tasks and love first, from yourself. That is all.
Let's stop for a moment and sort things out. It's true that I have not been able to love myself. I have deep feelings of inferiority, which have developed into an inferiority complex. I have not been able to separate the tasks that need to be separated. Objectively assessing the current discussion, that's about the sum of it. So, what can I do to dispel my feelings of inferiority? There's only one conclusion. That's to meet a person who will accept and love this me. Otherwise, there's no way I can love myself or anything like that.
So in other words, your position is, if you will love me, I will love you.
Well, I guess so, if you put it briefly.
So after all, you are only seeing, will this person love me? You seem to be looking at the other person, but you are only seeing yourself. If you are waiting around with such an attitude, who is going to love you? If there is anyone who would respond to such a self-centered need, it would be one's parents, because one's parents' love, especially one's mother's love, is unconditional.
You think you can treat me like a child?
Listen, that golden age is over, and the world is not your mother. You must take a straight look at the childhood lifestyle you have been carrying with you in secret and make it new. Don't wait for someone who will love you to appear.
We're totally going around in circles.
There is no destined one.
We must not stand still. Let us take another step forward. At the outset today, in our discussion concerning education, I spoke of two things that cannot be forced.
Yes, respect and love.
Right. No matter what sort of dictator I might be, I cannot force people to respect me. In a relationship of respect, the only way is for the respect to come from me first. That is the only thing I can do, regardless of what sort of attitude the other person might take in response. This is what I was talking about earlier.
Then are you saying that it's the same with love?
Yes. Love cannot be forced, either.
You still haven't answered my main question, however. Look, I do have the feeling of wanting to love someone. In all sincerity, I do. Aside from my fear of love, I have the feeling that I am thirsting for love. Then why don't I launch into love? It's because I haven't been able to meet the crucial person one should love. I haven't been able to meet my destined partner, so my wish for love doesn't come true. The meeting is the most difficult problem of all with regard to love.
So, true love starts with a destined meeting?
But of course it does. Because your partner is someone you devote your life to and who changes the subject of life. You can't pretend you can offer up everything about yourself to just anyone.
Then what sort of person would you call a destined one? That is to say, how would you sense that it is destiny?
I don't know. I guess I'll know when that time comes. It's unknown territory to me.
I see. Then let's start by answering with Adler's basic position on this. Whether in love or in life in general, Adler does not accept the existence of a destined one of any kind.
There's no destined one for us?
There is not.
Wait, that is not a statement I can just let pass.
Why do many people seek a destined one in love? Why do we entertain romantic illusions of our marriage partners? The reason, Adler concludes, is to eliminate all the candidates.
To eliminate the candidates?
People who lament that they can't meet anyone, as you do, are actually meeting someone or other on a daily basis. Barring highly unusual circumstances, there is no one who has not met someone in the past year. You have met many people yourself, haven't you?
Well, if you are going to include just being in the same place as them.
However, to grow that modest meeting into some kind of relationship requires a certain courage. To call out to people and send letters and such.
Yes, it sure does. It requires not just a certain courage, but the greatest courage of all.
So what does a person do when they lose the courage to embark on a relationship? They cling to fantasies of a destined one, just like you are doing now. Even though there often is a person to love right in front of them, they come up with all sorts of reasons to reject each one, and they lower their eyes and think, there's got to be a more ideal, more perfect, destined partner. They try not to enter into deeper relationships, and they unilaterally eliminate any and all candidates.
No way.
By bringing forward excessive and unrealizable ideals in this way, they avoid anything that may lead to interactions with real, living people. Please see that this is the truth of the person who laments that they can't meet anyone.
I am running away from relationships?
And you are living within the realm of possibility. You think of happiness as something that will come from somewhere else. Happiness hasn't come my way yet, but if I can just meet the person of my destiny, everything will be fine.
Damn it. Ah, what damn insight you have.
I am sure that this is not something that feels good to hear, but if you consider the goal of seeking a destined one, the discussion will always come to this point as a matter of course.
Love is a decision.
Then let's hear it. If there is no destined one, on account of what do we decide to get married? Marriage is making the choice to spend the rest of your life with that one and only person in the whole wide world, isn't it? Surely you're not saying it's just a matter of choosing according to such terms as appearance, finances, and social position, are you?
Marriage is not a matter of choosing a target. It is a matter of choosing one's way of living.
Choosing a way of living? Then the target can be anyone?
Ultimately, yes.
Don't mess around. Who would ever recognize such a statement? Retract that. Retract it right away.
I recognize that this is a view that is met with a great deal of opposition, but we are able to love anyone.
I'm not joking. If that's the case, could you just go out and find some woman walking by without the slightest idea of who she is or where she's from and love that woman and marry her?
If I made the decision to do that.
The decision?
Of course, there are many people who felt destiny on meeting someone and decided to get married in accordance with that intuition. But that is not a previously established destiny. It is only that one decided to believe it was destiny. As Fromm remarked, loving someone is not simply an intense emotion. It is a decision. It is a judgment. It is a promise. It doesn't matter how the meeting happens. If one makes the firm decision to build real love from that point, and one confronts the task accomplished by two people, love is possible with any partner.
Don't you realize? You're spitting on your own marriage right now. You are saying, my wife wasn't the person of my destiny, and anyone could have been my partner. Would you declare that in front of your family? If you would, then you are an over-the-top nihilist.
It is not nihilism. It is realism. Adlerian psychology negates all determinism and rejects fatalism. There is no destined one or anything of the sort for us, and one must not wait for such a person to appear. Nothing will change by having waited. I do not intend to yield on this principle. However, on looking back on the many years one has journeyed together with one's partner, one may feel the presence of a destined something there. Destiny in that case is not a predetermined thing, nor is it something that has rained down upon one by chance. It should be something that has been built up by the effort of two people.
What do you mean?
I'm sure you understand already. Destiny is something you create with your own two hands. We must not become destiny's servants. We must be the masters of our destinies. Rather than seeking a destined person, we build relationships of a kind that might be referred to as destined.
But, concretely speaking, what are you saying one should do?
One dances. Without thinking about a future one could never comprehend or about a destiny that could never exist, one simply engages in a dance of the now with the partner before one. Adler recommended dancing to many people, including children, as a pastime of two human beings taking part in cooperative work. Love and marriage are indeed akin to the dance that two people make together. Without ever thinking about where one would like to go, they take each other by the hand, and looking straight at the happiness of the day that is today, at just this moment called now, they keep on dancing round and round. People will speak of the tracks of the long dance you two have created as destiny.
Love and marriage are the dance that two people make together.
You are standing now at the edge of the dance floor of life and watching other people dance. You are assuming that there couldn't be anyone who would dance with someone like me, while in your heart you are waiting impatiently for your destined one to reach their hand out to you. You are doing everything you can to endure and to protect yourself so that you do not feel any more miserable than you do already, and so that you do not begin to dislike yourself. There is one thing that you should do. Take the hand of the person beside you and try to do the best dance that you can possibly do in that moment. Your destiny will start from there.
Re-choose your lifestyle.
The guy watching at the edge of the dance floor. As usual, you treat people like they're old rags. The thing is, I have tried to do the dance, of course. I have actually tried dancing. I mean, I have been with someone who could be called a lover.
Yes, I am sure you have.
But it wasn't the kind of relationship that could have ever led to marriage, both for me and for her. We weren't together to love each other. It was just that we wanted to be able to say that I was her boyfriend and she was my girlfriend. Both of us understood well enough that it was a relationship that would come to an end at some point. We never once talked about our future together, let alone getting married. It was a passing relationship.
In the days of our youth, we do have such relationships.
Moreover, I regarded her as a compromise from the start. I told myself, I've got various complaints, but I'm not in the position to aim higher. With her, I'll be living within my means. I think that she probably chose me for the same kind of reason. Well, thinking about it now, it's a pretty embarrassing way of thinking. Even if it was true that I couldn't aim higher.
It is a great thing that you have been able to face that feeling.
Then I really want to ask you this. What was it that made you resolve to get married? No destined one or whatever exists, and there's no telling what'll happen to you in the future. There's always the possibility that someone more attractive will come along. If you get married, that possibility disappears. But then how do we, actually, I mean you, how did you resolve to get married to this person and no one else?
I wanted to be happy.
Huh?
If I loved this person, I could be happier. That's what I thought. Looking back on it now, I realize that it was a mentality of seeking an our happiness that went beyond my happiness. I did not know about Adler at the time, however, and I had never given any reasoned thought to love and marriage. I only wanted to be happy. That is all.
Well, me too. Everyone gets together in hopes of being happy, but surely that's a different thing from marriage.
But your hope was not to be happy, was it? It was simply the desire for things to be easier.
What?
Awaiting a love relationship is not free of difficulty. The responsibility one must take on is great, and painful things and unforeseeable hardships may lie ahead. Is one still capable of loving in the face of that? Does one have the resolve, no matter what troubles arise, to love this person and walk beside them? Can one make that feeling into a promise?
The responsibility of love?
Suppose, for example, a person who says, I like flowers, but lets them wither right away. This person forgets to water them, doesn't think of transplanting them into a different pot or adjusting the amount of light, and just puts the flower pot in a place where they look nice. To be sure, it may be true that the person likes looking at flowers, but one could not say that this person loves flowers. Love is a more dedicated approach. It is the same with you. You were avoiding the responsibility that should be shouldered by the one who loves. You just devoured the fruit of your passion without watering the flowers or planting the seeds. That is truly a fleeting, hedonistic love.
I know it. I didn't love her. I just took advantage of her good intentions.
It is not that you didn't love her. You didn't know what loving was. If you had known, I am sure you would have been able to build a relationship of destiny with that woman.
With her? I could have. With her?
As Fromm says, love is an act of faith, and whoever is of little faith is also of little love. Adler, in place of this faith, would use the word courage. You were of little courage, so you were able to love only a little. Not possessing the courage to love, you tried to stay in the lifestyle of your childhood, the lifestyle of being loved. That is all.
With the courage to love, she and I could have.
Yes, the courage to love. That is to say, the courage to be happy.
You're saying that if I'd had the courage to be happy back then, I could have loved her and faced the task accomplished by two people?
And you would have achieved self-reliance.
No, I don't get it. Because is it just love is all? Is love really the only way we can find happiness?
Love is all. The person who lives wanting an easy life or looking for the easy way may find fleeting pleasures, but they will not be able to grasp real happiness. It is only by loving another person that we are liberated from self-centeredness. It is only by loving another person that we can achieve self-reliance. And it is only by loving another person that we arrive at community feeling.
But didn't you say before that happiness is a feeling of contribution, and that if one has a feeling of contribution, one can find happiness? Was that a lie?
It is not a lie. The issue here is one's method for gaining a feeling of contribution, or rather, one's way of living. By nature, a person should be able to contribute to someone just by being there. One is already contributing by one's being, not by acts that can be seen. There is no need to do anything special.
That's a lie! There's no way to really feel such a thing.
That is because you are living with me as the subject. When you know love and live with us as the subject, that will change. You will gain the real feeling of an us that includes the entire human race in which people are contributing to each other simply by living.
I will gain a real feeling of an us that includes not only my partner, but the entire human race?
In other words, you will gain community feeling. Well, I cannot enter any further into your tasks, but if you were to ask my advice, I would probably say something like this. Love. Be self-reliant. And choose life.
Love, be self-reliant, and choose life.
Look, the eastern sky has begun to lighten.
The youth now understood with his entire being the love described by Adler.
If I have the courage to be happy, I will be able to love someone, and I will re-choose my life. I'll achieve true self-reliance.
The thick fog that had been clouding his vision was clearing before him. But the youth did not know yet that awaiting him beyond the clearing fog was not some beautiful Eden-like meadow. That to love, be self-reliant, and choose life would be a difficult path. Keeping it simple.
That's some conclusion.
Let's wrap things up here, and let's make tonight our final meeting.
Huh?
This study is not a place where young people like you visit again and again. And more important, you are an educator. The place you should be is in the classroom, and the comrades you should be speaking with are the children who will live in the future.
But I haven't figured things out yet. If we just stop here, I'll definitely lose my way. Because I haven't made it to Adler's stairway yet.
It's true that you have not begun climbing the stairway, but you have made it to the point where you have a foot on the first step. 3 years ago, I said, the world is simple, and life is too. And now that we have finished our discussion today, I will supplement it with a few more words.
And they are?
That the world is simple, and life is too. But also, keeping it simple is difficult. It is there that the passage of nothing days becomes one's trial.
Ah!
Knowing about Adler, being in agreement with Adler, and accepting Adler are not enough to change one's life. People often say that the first step is crucial, that everything will be fine if you just get past it. Of course, it is true that the biggest turning point is the first step. In real life, however, the trials of nothing days begin only after one has embarked on that first step. What is really being tested is one's courage to keep walking on one's path, just as it is in philosophy.
It's really those days that are a trial.
You are likely to run into conflicts with Adler on many occasions. You will have doubts. You may want to stop walking, and you may tire of loving and want to seek a life of being loved. And you may want to visit this study again. But at that time, please talk with the children, with your comrades who will live in the coming era, and if you are able, rather than simply inheriting Adler's ideas just as they are, please go about updating them yourselves.
We should update Adler?
Adler did not hope for his psychology to become didactically fixed in place and passed down only among specialists. His hope was that his psychology would be positioned as a psychology for everyone and continue to thrive far from the world of academia as a common sense of the people. We are not a religion endowed with eternal scriptures, and Adler is not our sacred founder, but a philosopher who existed on the same level as us. Times change. New arts are born, new relationships and new worries also. The common sense of the people undergoes a slow transformation in tandem with the changing times. It is precisely because we value Adler's ideas that we must continue to update them. We must not turn into fundamentalists. This is the mission entrusted to the human beings who will live in the new era.
To the friends who will make a new era.
But what about you? What will you do from now on?
I suppose that other young people who catch wind of me will come, because no matter how the times change, people's worries stay the same. Please remember, the time we are given is limited. And as our time is limited, all our interpersonal relationships come into being on the premise of our parting. This is not a nihilistic term. The reality is that we meet in order to part.
Yes, undoubtedly.
And so there is one thing we can do. Devote our ceaseless efforts in all our meetings and all our interpersonal relationships toward the best possible parting. That is all.
Our ceaseless efforts toward the best possible parting?
One devotes one's ceaseless efforts so that when the day of parting comes, one will be able to be satisfied that meeting this person and passing the time together with this person was not a mistake. Whether it is in one's relationship with one's students, in one's relationship with one's parents, or in one's relationship with the person one loves. If, for example, your relationship with your parents came to an end all of a sudden, or a relationship with a student or a friend came to an end, would you be able to accept it as the best possible parting?
No, that's so...
Then you have no choice but to start building now the kind of relationship that would make you feel that way. That is what is meant by live earnestly here and now.
It's not too late. It won't be too late if I start now?
It is not too late.
But it takes time to put Adler's ideas into practice. You even told me so yourself. One needs half the number of years one has lived.
Yes, but that is the view of an Adlerian researcher. Adler himself said something completely different in this regard.
What did he say?
In response to the question, is there a time limit for a person to change, Adler replied, yes, there certainly is a time limit. And then, with a mischievous smile, he added, until the day before you meet your maker.
Some friend.
Let's embark on love and devote our ceaseless efforts toward the best possible parting with that person we have loved. There is no need to worry about time limits or anything like that.
Do you think it is something I can do? Devote my ceaseless efforts?
Of course. Ever since we met, 3 years ago, we have been devoting ourselves to those efforts. And now, in this way, we are approaching our best possible parting. We should have no regrets for our time together.
No, none at all.
I am proud to be able to part while having such a refreshing feeling. To me, you are the best possible friend. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, of course. I'm thankful, too. I'm thankful to hear that. I really am. But I'm not confident that I am a person who is worthy of those words. Is it really necessary to part forever here? Can't we ever meet again?
It is your independence, your self-reliance as a lover of wisdom, that is to say, as a philosopher. Didn't I say it 3 years ago that the answers should not be something you get from someone else, but something you arrive at on your own? You are ready to do that.
Independence from you.
I have gained a great hope today. Your students will graduate, love someone someday, achieve self-reliance, and become true adults. And one day, there will be dozens, even hundreds of such students, and maybe the times will catch up with Adler.
That is truly the objective I had in mind 3 years ago when I set forth on the path of education.
You are the one who will make that future. There is no hesitating. We cannot see the future because there are infinite possibilities, and that is precisely why we can become the masters of our destinies.
It's true. I can't see a thing ahead of me, nothing at all. It's almost refreshing.
I have never once accepted disciples, and in all my interactions with you, I have been very careful not to have any awareness of you as a disciple. But now that I have conveyed to you everything that needed to be conveyed, I have the feeling that I have understood something at last.
And what would that be?
What I have been searching for is not disciples or successors, but a running partner. You will probably encourage me along my path as an irreplaceable running partner who upholds the same ideals as me. From now on, wherever you are, I am sure I will continue to feel your presence close by.
Yes, I will run. I will run beside you, always.
Well, it is time to raise your head and go back to the classroom. The students are waiting, and a new era is waiting for all of you.
The philosopher's study, separated from the outside world.
One step outside that door, chaos awaits me. Noise and discord and unending everyday life await me.
The world is simple, and life is too. But keeping it simple is difficult, and it is there that the passage of nothing days becomes one's trial.
It's true. There's no two ways about it. But I'm going to throw myself into the chaos again, regardless. Because my comrades, my students, are living in the midst of great chaos. Because that is the place where I live.
The youth took a deep breath and, with grim determination, opened the door. Afterward.
This volume is the sequel to The Courage to be Disliked, which was co-written with Mr. Ichiro Kishimi and published in 2013. There were no plans to write a sequel at the outset. Maybe our book did not convey everything about Alfred Adler, but it was a success in its distilling of the essence of his thought. The Courage to be Disliked generated a favorable response, and I could not really see the significance of writing a continuation for a book that already had its conclusion. Then, one day, about a year after the publication of that book, in the midst of a chat about trivial matters, Mr. Kishimi let slip the following words. If Socrates and Plato were alive today, they might have chosen the path of psychology instead of that of philosophy. Socrates and Plato would have become psychiatrists? The ideas of Greek philosophy could be brought into a clinical setting? I was so taken aback, I could not speak for a moment. Mr. Kishimi is the foremost specialist in Adlerian psychology in Japan, and is a philosopher with enough of a familiarity with ancient Greece to be able to handle the translation of Plato. So it was not a statement that made light of Greek philosophy, of course. If I were to specify one thing that led to the making of The Courage to be Happy, I suppose it would have to be this particular comment from Mr. Kishimi. Adlerian psychology addresses all manner of life problems in plain language that can be understood by anyone without ever making use of obscure terminology of any kind. It is a form of thought endowed with qualities more akin to philosophy than psychology. It seems to me that The Courage to be Disliked was widely accepted as a life philosophy, rather than as a book on psychology. On the other hand, doesn't this philosophical quality actually reveal the incompleteness of Adler's thought as a psychology and point to its flaws as a science? Isn't that why Adler became a forgotten giant? Isn't the very fact that it is not complete as a psychology the reason it did not take root in the academic world? I had interacted with Adler's thought without ever ridding myself of such doubts. In the end, it was Mr. Kishimi's statement that shed light on them. Adler did not choose psychology in order to analyze the human mind. Inspired to set off on the path of medicine on the occasion of his younger brother's death, the core matter of his thought was always, what is happiness to the human being? And at the beginning of the 20th century, when Adler was alive, the most advanced approach to learning about human beings and to inquiring into the true form of happiness just happened to be psychology. One must not fall under the spell of the name Adlerian psychology, or spend too much time comparing him to Freud and Jung. Had Adler been born in ancient Greece, he might well have chosen philosophy, and had Socrates and Plato been born in our time, they might have chosen psychology. As Mr. Kishimi often says, Adlerian psychology is a way of thinking that follows in the same vein as Greek philosophy. At long last, I feel that I can grasp the meaning of these words. And so, after a thorough rereading of Adler's writings as philosophy texts, I visited Mr. Kishimi's home in Kyoto once again, and we engaged in a lengthy dialogue. Naturally, the main subject of our discussion was happiness theory. It is that question consistently posed by Adler: what is happiness to a human being? Our dialogue, which became even more impassioned than the previous time, explored education theory, organizational theory, work theory, social theory, and even extended to life theory before reaching its conclusion with the grand themes of love and self-reliance. How will the listener take in the love and self-reliance Adler speaks of? If the listener can feel, as I did, a great astonishment and hope of the sort that sends shockwaves through one's entire life, I would know no greater joy. Lastly, I would like to convey my heartfelt gratitude to Mr. Ichiro Kishimi, who always tackled things head-on as the wisdom-loving philosopher he is, to our editors, Yoshifumi Kakiuchi and Diamond Inc.'s Kenji Imaizumi, who gave their steadfast support throughout the lengthy writing period. And most of all, to all our listeners, thank you very much. Fumitake Koga.
Alfred Adler was an oft misunderstood thinker for many years. With his encouragement approach in particular, there were innumerable instances of it being presented or even abused for purposes that could not be further removed from his original intentions. That is to say, it was used to control and manipulate other people in child-rearing and school education settings, as well as in human resource development settings in corporations and the like. This may be related to the fact that, compared to other psychologists of his time, Adler was passionate about education. Deeply interested in socialism while at university, after experiencing the realities of the Russian Revolution after World War I, Adler lost hope in Marxism. Thereafter, he sought the salvation of the human race, not through political reform, but through educational reform. One of Adler's greatest achievements was the establishment of numerous child guidance clinics, the first in the world in public schools under the aegis of the city of Vienna. Furthermore, he used these child guidance clinics not only for providing treatment to children and their parents, but as places for training teachers, doctors, and counselors. In essence, it was from there that Adlerian psychology spread from its start in schools to the world. To Adler, education was not something on the level of raising scholastic achievement or reforming problem children or that sort of thing. It was for moving the human race forward and changing the future. That was education to him. Adler goes so far as to declare, "The teacher molds the minds of children and holds the future of mankind in his hands." Then, did Adler have such expectations only for those in the teaching profession? No, he did not. As is evident from his characterization of counseling as re-education, for Adler, all people living in a community were engaged with education, and all people were in the position of receiving education. I, too, having first encountered Adler through child-rearing, have actually gained a great deal of human knowledge from children. Of course, you, too, must be both an educator and a student. Regarding his psychology, Adler stated, "Understanding a human being is no easy matter. Of all the forms of psychology, individual psychology is probably the most difficult to learn and put into practice." One cannot change anything just by studying Adler. One will make no progress whatsoever just by knowing it as knowledge. And though one may have gathered one's courage and taken the first step, it won't do if one stops there. Take the next step, and then the next step after that. Map and compass in hand, what sort of path will you walk from now on? Or will you stay in place? If this book can be of some help in gaining the courage to be happy, nothing would give me more joy. Ichiro Kishimi.
The courage to be happy. The Japanese phenomenon that shows you that true contentment is within your power was written by Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitake Koga and read by Graham Malcolm, Noah Galvin, and January Lavoie. It was recorded at Beat Street Studios by Steve Wagner, Carnegie Hall by Leszek Wojcik in New York City, and Magic Lantern by John St. Denis in Atlanta. Editing by Christina Pichano. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Claire Todicoro. The Courage to be Happy was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Courage to be Happy. The Japanese phenomenon that shows you that true contentment is within your power is available in print from Atria. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, The Courage to be Disliked. The Japanese phenomenon that shows you how to change your life and achieve real happiness. Written by Ichiro Kishimi and Fumitake Koga. And read by Graham Malcolm, Noah Galvin, and January Lavoie.